Hello. Now then, I'd like you to listen to a couple of sounds.
It was a complete creation of his own making.
I was the very, very first in the whole world.
I've got plenty of other people. I've got four sisters and two brothers. They've all got plenty of kids. I've got plenty of kids on Jimbo Fixit. So my kids, to me anyway, the best sorts of kids, is they all go home to their parents.
Me to do things for him. He wants me to fondle him. He asked me for oral sex.
We gave him every instrument that he needed in Broughton to prey on some extremely damaged individuals.
Sir James Savile, OBE, the man who has single-handedly raised more than £30 million for charity.
Why have you said in interviews that you don't have emotions?
Because it's easier. The truth is, I'm very good at masking them.
I'm a rare breed insofar as I'm a single fella, and which is why when people say, them five places you've got to live in, aren't they expensive? And I say, not as expensive as a wife.
Now, the Metropolitan Police say that it will now take the lead in investigating sex abuse allegations against the late Sir Jimmy Savile as more women come forward claiming to have been assaulted by the television presenter.
Who's your best pal, Tony?
Oh, no, Desmond.
He's not.
He is.
No, he's not.
Yeah, that's me.
Because he's a married man.
Do you care?
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Well, no.
I'm just squashing.
Not until you say me.
Now, me, when I stand in front of the table and St. Peter's there, he says, you are not coming in. And I'll say, well, why not? And he'll say, because you're a villain. And he'll show me the debit side. And I'll say, hang about. And I'll show him the credit side. And he'll say, does that mean anything? And if he says, that means nothing, then I'll threaten to break his fingers.
What does she do with the cable, boys?
And I didn't want to. And he promised me that if I gave him oral sex, that he would arrange for me and my friends to go to Television Central and be on his television show.
Hey, hey, hey! We've got it all happening tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody's around. We're going to start with our guests.
Hope it's been a very good week for you. And here's a very good set of fixes for you. Here we go now with a letter from Leeds. Yeah, Leeds.
Me?
So, I promise.
I promise.
That you, Jimmy Savile.
You, Jimmy Savile.
Are the only one.
Are the only one.
In my life.
I was 14. Of course I wanted to go to Television Centre. I didn't want to give him more facts. I thought it was disgusting, but I did that. Gary Glitter was one example. He was particularly horrible. And only interested in getting as much sex as he could possibly get from any girl.
I'd start with manipulative, then controlling, and very, very clever.
It has become a great British institution. Not bad for just another zany DJ, but there's a lot more to cigar-smoking Jimmy than meets the eye.
I can remember seeing him having sex with one of the girls from Duncroft in Jimmy Savile's dressing room.
That I was the very, very first in the whole world to run a dance to record.
You used to be a wrestler, didn't you?
I still am.
Are you?
I'm feared in every girls' school in this country.
Hello and welcome once again to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our 13th look at the life and crimes of Jimmy Savile. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, as always, I have my normal plugs. If you'd like to follow me on social media, that would be Facebook, Instagram, MeWe. Just search for either Ian Totten, author, or The Deathcast. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter or Truth Media, you can find me under Corpse Creek Publishing. If you'd like to connect with the show and stay up to date with all the happenings in my world, you can go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com, drop me a line there, sign up for the show's mailing list. If you're feeling particularly enamored with the show, you can click on the donate button and buy me a cup of coffee or a pack of smokes. If you are interested in becoming a Patreon member of the show for as little as $2 a month, you can help support the show and help offset the cost of production. You can go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon and sign up there. If you're interested in finding any of my novels, you can go to tinyurl.com/totten-books. I have 6 novels out, with a 7th currently in the works. If you like the show and want to tell others about it, you can share it onto social media from your favorite podcast player. While you're there, please click on the subscribe button and consider leaving a 5-star review. Every 5-star review means another person has the potential of hearing the show. It also means I don't have to launch a kitten out of a cannon in order to get people's attention. Lastly, I would like to thank Angie, who emailed me a couple of times this week to inform me of the issues with the show playing on Google Podcasts. State it here publicly for everyone to hear. I am very well aware of the issues with the Deathcast playing on Google Podcast. I'd like you to know that I've been on top of it. However, this is an issue coming from Google's side. It's not an issue from the show feed. You can find the show feed at welcometothedeathcast.com. When we left off last week, it was the mid to late 1980s. Seville is really entrenched in the establishment within Great Britain. He had been given the keys to Broadmoor State Hospital, which was a hospital for the criminally insane that housed individuals such as Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, I believe, although I may be mistaken, that Ian Brady, one of the Moors murderers, may have been there at one point, as well as a slew of other notorious criminals from Britain's past. And the reason he had been given these keys is because Seville had been placed onto an oversight committee that was charged with running Broadmoor. This was due to the fact that the hospital up until that point had been seen to have been run poorly. There was accusations of misappropriations of funds, mismanagement, abuse of patients, you name it. So the British government decided that this hospital needed to have an oversight committee who would effect changes within it, and Seville was put on this, and this was a very big deal in Great Britain at the time, and it's still talked about to this day how a lowly television presenter and DJ was placed in such a high position of trust overseeing criminals who had mental issues, particularly when, to the naked eye, it was obvious that Seville had no real qualifications to hold this post. But upon closer inspection, it's beyond apparent that he really had no qualifications other than the fact that he was seen as an individual who didn't ask questions. He just got things done. If he was tasked with raising funds for a particular organization or getting new structures built for an organization, Seville went out and did it, no questions asked. Obviously, there was, from his end, as well as those who were asking him to do these things, an expectation that he would be repaid for his abilities and for getting these things done further on down the line. And we are at that point where Seville is going to be getting repaid for all of the good works he had done for the people of Great Britain. Yes, I am talking about the knighting of Jimmy Seville, OBE. This one act really is the pinnacle of Saville's career and his life. After he is knighted, things really begin to slow down in his world. Yes, he's still doing charity work. He still has his television shows, Jim'll Fix It. He's still involved with Top of the Pops on occasion. Here and there doing radio shows and various commercials. But really, after he gets knighted, Saville really begins to move away from the public consciousness in regards to he's not in the public eye as he once had been. You have to understand, at this point, Saville is pushing, I believe, 60 years old, give or take. So he's naturally, the body slows down. He doesn't have the energy that he once had. Well, this would have been a death sentence for a normal individual. Saville, because he was such a master at self-promotion, was still able to keep himself in the public eye to some extent, and we will get into that in a moment. First, we're going to look at how Saville spent a lot of his time away from the limelight, as it were. Throughout the 80s, particularly after the finish of the Stoke Mandeville initiative that he had spearheaded, Jimmy had a lot more free time on his hands away from the cameras. He had thrown himself back into exercising with, some would say, a renewed vigor, riding bikes, his running, which had always been a part of his persona. But he was also spending much more time inside the hospitals that he was doing charity work at. Some have stated that Saville took this opportunities inside the wards to abuse patients. In fact, there are a number of articles out there, as well as reports that were compiled, stating that Saville abused hundreds, if not thousands, of patients within these wards. But there are just as many accounts that state the opposite, that in fact, Saville seemed to be a lonely person, and that what he was really doing was looking for some form of human companionship. There are numerous accounts out there of him walking the wards at night looking for a patient who is just as sleepless as he was, wanting somebody to talk with, and that Saville would find these patients and spend the evenings regaling them with stories of his life and career. Former Trade and Industry Minister Lord Norman Tebbit encountered Saville when he was at the Stoke Mandeville Hospital. According to Tebbit, he saw nothing of the sort of accusations that would be leveled against Jimmy after his passing. In fact, Tebbit stated that Saville had him laughing so hard that he demanded the man leave because it was hurting his broken ribs. After Saville's passing, Tebbit gave this statement. Now, bear in mind that this statement was given after the accusations against Jimmy came out. "I've no doubt Jimmy Saville was a very odd fellow, and I'm pretty sure he was in breach of the law in a number of matters. But I do not know that it's possible, 40 years on, to do justice in the sense of knowing just how many of those allegations are completely true. Jimmy did a great deal of good, as well as wrong, and in anybody's life, you have to look at both sides of the ledger." Interesting of note, Lord Tebbit and his wife further stated that they both got the sense from Jimmy that he was in fact a homosexual masquerading as a straight man. As we know from all we've discussed concerning Saville, that was anything but the truth. In addition to taking up more exercise and volunteering at the hospitals, Jimmy also attached his name to a book that came out called Stranger Danger, which was all about, as the title suggests, children being abducted and abused by strangers. Saville stated, "I've got nothing to hide. I don't read smut and I don't like it, but the older I get, the more advisable it is to have a policy. I mean, people look at you and say, what's under that stone? Most people believe something is there. I'm saying they would be all disappointed." when this came out was also around the time that Jimmel Fix It celebrated its 10th year on the television. That statement that I just read from Saville is directly from a newspaper article he gave in The Sun on the day that the show celebrated its 10th year. And the article has become somewhat notorious because in it, Jimmy states rather emphatically that he does not like children in any way, shape, or form. Later on in his life, he would tell the documentary filmmaker Louis Theroux that he had said this in order to throw tabloid people off the trail, because if he had stated that he liked children, they would immediately begin attempting to plaster him with the label of pedophile. Saville would elaborate numerous times over the year, stating that children were his bread and butter through Jimmel Fix It and his other various works, but he found them loud, annoying, and a nuisance. Whether or not there is anything behind this statement from Jimmy, I'll leave up to you, the listeners. Personally, I think, like so many things he said over the years, it was just another one of those throwaway lines that he gave to a reporter in order to get his name in print, and then a position that he found himself having to defend because so many people had latched onto it when it came out. Also interesting of note, during this period of time, 88-89, Saville really deepens his ties with the Royals. He was brought in as really an unpaid expert on media relations to help Sarah Ferguson, who I believe was the Duchess of York at this period of time, because she was getting a lot of negative publicity. And Jimmy was seen as a man who knew all about publicity, whether it was positive or negative. And to some degree, he was able to do this. But more importantly, he really got in bed with Prince Charles and Lady Diana. People have made a lot of the fact that Diana constantly called on him in an effort to help her repair her damaged marriage. But it wasn't just Diana who sought Saville out. It was also Charles. There are a number of records stating either Charles went and visited Jimmy, or Saville came to visit Charles, or they made phone calls back and forth, sent telegrams and letters to each other. So that's where this deep-seated admiration for the Royals really was bound in blood, as it were. It had really begun during the 70s with Lord Mountbatten, but it had grown exponentially since then. Then you had the Stoke Mandeville Initiative, which, again, Saville was able to get Charles and Diana to put their names to. Now you actually have the Royals seeking out Jimmy to help them with their relationships. He was in a very, very unique position that most others within society, whether they were famous and powerful or not, ever found themselves in. And this was a relationship that continued on throughout Jimmy's lifetime. As I stated in another episode, when going through his things, Saville's secretary pulled out a letter addressed to Jimmy that stated, "This is to go to some way towards repaying the debt the English society owes you. I doubt they shall ever know how much you've done for them." I believe this letter accompanied a set of onyx cufflinks, if I'm not mistaken. But in any event, it shows you just how ingrained within their world Saville had become at this point. And really, this is where that ingratiation comes from is Jimmy helping Ferguson as well as Charles and Diana with their personal lives. All of this, the charity work, the ingratiation with the royals, it was all leading towards a specific end, and that was that Jimmy wanted to be knighted, and he had the royals on his side, but apparently they really don't have a say in who gets a knighthood and who does not. It actually comes down to a committee who is in charge of bestowing the Queen's New Year's honors. As discussed in the last two episodes, Saville had the Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher really pumping this committee to get him a knighthood. And during the summer of 1991, it was announced that Jimmy had finally reached the penultimum of his career and was going to be included on this rarefied list. When a reporter who Saville was friends with asked him about the impending knighthood, he stated this. First, he was asked why he thought it had taken so long for them to get around to giving him a knighthood. Saville stated, "I would imagine I unsettled the establishment because the establishment would say, yes, Jimmy's a good chap, but a bit strange. And I think maybe in the past I suffered from the vulgarity of success. Because if you're successful in what you do, you can become a pain in the neck to a lot of people, especially if you're doing it in a volunteer manner, right? I had a lively couple of years with the tabloids sniffing about, asking around the corner shops, everything, thinking there must be something the authorities knew that they didn't. Whereas in actual fact, I've got to be the most boring geezer in the world because I ain't got no past, no nothing. And so, if nothing else, it was a ginormous relief when I got the knighthood because it got me off the hook." That is a statement that a number of people have pointed to in regards to the allegations against Saville. When he said it got me off the hook, many people say, what is he, was he talking about when he said got him off the hook for what? Well, those who believe all of the accusations clearly state that they thought when he stated that he was talking about, it basically made him free and clear from any charges ever sticking against him. That very well could be the case, as it is an odd statement to make when being bestowed such a great honor, especially one that so few are given in their lifetimes. Personally, I think it was Saville's way of stating that he had finally, at least in his eyes, made it and was seen as a legitimate individual by the establishment, as opposed to this rather strange and comical court jester, which he had been portrayed as for so much of his career. Something interesting in Saville's life at this point is, at least according to the woman who was involved, Arvel Harris, she got into a relationship with Jimmy. Now, at this period of time, she was 46 years old and Jimmy was 64. Arvel stated that the relationship did not last long as Saville was never around, but she also had the sinking suspicion that he had been with other women when he was not with her. But she did give a brief glimpse into the real Jimmy Saville when she talked about the night before he was invested as a Knight of the Realm of England. She stated that Jimmy was sitting on the bed naked when he suddenly began crying softly, and when Arvel went over and attempted to, calm him down and find out what was wrong, she was told that Seville felt overwhelmed, and what an important moment and milestone in his life the impending knighthood was. When Saville was knighted the next morning, he is supposed to have quipped to Arville, "This is the start of a new chapter in my life," whereas Jimmy Seville could be had for 10,000 quid. Sir Jim comes quite a bit more expensively. And that really does boil down to the character of Jimmy Seville. How much can he make from a thing, and what is the thing he is getting involved with going to do with his public perception?
Ian Totten, best-selling author, The House of Silver Doors, The Blood Gods Trilogy, Maggie. A book which New York Times best-selling author Keith Elliott Greenberg has called a classic detective story, well-crafted, and a supernatural vortex. Maggie, the name was burned into Lieutenant Carl Jablonski's mind like a brand, and had been since the night of the fire. He doubted he would ever forget that night, or how she had danced in the flames of her burning home. Maggie, who was she, and why did no one in Kaya's Crossing seem interested in talking about her or her family? These were questions without answers. Quandaries that drove Carl on as he explored the darkest of the town's secrets, desperate to unravel the knots that tied everything together. Maggie, Carl felt haunted by a visage, even as the local reporter, George Murphy, told him of the blood-soaked history that lay along their path, and the horrors that it held. None of it seemed real, and yet it was. The sacrifices, the screams, the pact with the nameless ones, and the hell that she had endured. Maggie, hers was a crime begging to be solved, and he and George are the only ones with enough heart to do it. The real question is, will they survive long enough to do it? Maggie, available 11/30/2021 in paperback and hardcover. E-book pre-orders are now available at Amazon.com. Only from Corpse Creek Publishing. You have been warned.
Not long after being knighted, Jimmy was given a very unique distinction, and this should go some towards showing you just how important and how integral a part of British life he was. The television show This Is Your Life, which had already done a program on him, I believe in the 1970s, took the unprecedented step of honoring him once again. An interesting bit from this particular episode of the show came at the end when the host, Michael Spiel, read a telegram which stated, "Jimmy, I and millions more salute you. God bless, Margaret Thatcher." That right there really is the pinnacle of Jimmy Savile's life and career. He gets his knighthood in the end of 91, beginning of 92. He's given the second appearance on This Is Your Life, and then Margaret Thatcher, who had just ended her reign as Prime Minister, publicly thanks him for all that he has done for British society. From this point onward, Jimmy really starts to recede from public life somewhat. Not as much as an individual we spoke about last week Cyril Smith, but he does start backing away some. He starts spending much more time working at the various hospitals. In 1994, Jim'll Fix It is finally taken off the air, despite the fact that it was still enormously popular. And really, during this period of time, when you look at Saville, it's very obvious that he is battling with himself in terms of his own morality. He's doing a ton of running. He's not in the public eye as much as he is used to being, although he's still there in some regard. He's still massively trusted by the royal family. And then he does an interview with a psychiatrist by the name of Anthony Clare. And I have yet to be able to find an actual copy of this interview as it aired on television, although I have read transcripts of it. And as Clare begins to question Saville during the course of the interview, Jimmy does his normal nonsensical patter before almost becoming defensive with the man as he presses him on issues such as his family life and sex and how he views the general public. Some takeaways from this interview are that Jimmy prizes money and material possessions above all else in life, including people, which, given his childhood where there wasn't much of anything, really isn't that hard to understand. Many people who have come from similar backgrounds as he did grow up to see life as nothing more than a series of purchases, keeping up with the Joneses, if you will, or even doing better than the Joneses, and that is exactly how Saville viewed life. It was one business deal after the other, and so long as he was left with more than he began with, then it was a success. When asked why he had bought 17 new Rolls Royces over the course of his life, Jimmy stated, "If a scandal comes up or the people go off you, you're finished. I could go and be very unhappy in the south of France, covered in shame and sunshine and mad birds with bikinis on for a long time because there was a new Rolls Royce there and a new this and a new that." When Claire pressed him on Saville's stated fear of being exposed by a scandal, Jimmy replied, "In actual fact, today the concern has been taken away. In the old days, we'll say 10 years ago, many people were ruined in my game by scandals that never existed. Today, it's not like that at all, because today we can actually sue people who tell lies." Another takeaway from the interview was Saville repeatedly talking about ultimate freedom, which he equated to not only his own lifestyle, but his lack of feelings, or if you prefer, his lack of emotions, which many people see as a sign of either a psychopath or a sociopath. This was something that Jimmy reiterated throughout his life over and over again, that he had no emotions, although he did confess, at least in one interview, that he did in fact have emotions. He was just very good at covering them. The end of the interview, Anthony Clare concluded that Jimmy was, quote, "a calculating materialist who had little need for people. He could cope with people needing him as long as they are satisfied with the things he is prepared and able to give them, in most instances material things, and in no instance himself." And I really think that is the be-all, end-all of Jimmy Saville. Everything in life to him was material. It's not how much you give away, it's how much you have. And I think that's one of the reasons that he never got into any sort of real relationship that we're aware of, because in his mind, bedding however many girls and women was to him the ultimate achievement in that part of his life. It didn't matter that he had one to hold on to as his own. He was concerned with numbers, as he was with everything else in his life. In fact, whenever anybody would interview him, he was very quick to point out every achievement that he had ever gotten in his life, all the awards he had been given, the amount of money he had raised for charity, how much money he was worth, how many homes he had, how many cars, etc., etc. And that really was the be-all, end-all of Saville's existence. The knighthood that he received in 92 was just an extension of that, because to Jimmy, the knighthood was another thing that he could have that other people didn't have, that he could show off to them and basically say, "See, look how special I am, don't you know who I am?" Even with all of this stuff, however, there were still stories swirling around concerning Jimmy and things he had done in the past and was even doing in the present day. One newspaper had a group of young women approach them from the Duncroft School, where Saville had spent much time in the 1970s into the 1980s, where he took advantage of these very smart but misguided young girls and women in order to facilitate his sexual desires. These young women at this period in time went to the newspaper talking about things that Jimmy had gotten them to do. And while the editor of the newspaper believed these women's stories, without any sort of proof, he was nervous to go forward with pursuing the story. As I've discussed in other episodes, one of the reasons for this was the fact that Saville was so litigious. If he or his lawyers even got so much as a whiff that a newspaper was about to publish an unflattering story about them, he was very quick to react, calling them up or having his lawyer call them up to let them know, A, who exactly Jimmy Saville was, and B, they would have no problem settling this matter in court. According to these young women, they went so far as to send a number of letters to Saville at Stoke Mandeville Hospital, talking about the things that he had pressed them into doing during the 1970s. Saville's secretary at the time, Janet Cope, has repeatedly stated that she never received any of this type of letter from anyone, and she would know, as she was the woman who opened up all of the mail that was addressed to him, whether it was from Kings and Queens or the little man on the street. Every letter, everything that was sent to Saville went through her hands. When asked if she had ever received any letters like this, Janet stated she had not, but she further stated that had she gotten any letters such as the ones that were claimed to have been sent concerning the abuses at Duncroft School, she would have tossed them into the rubbish pile, believing them to have been from, you know, what she called cranks. But it is interesting to note that while Janet Cope has said that Jimmy Saville was not a nice individual, subsequent to his passing, of course, she has repeatedly reiterated that she never got any idea of the things that he is supposed to have been up to, nor did she ever receive any letters from anyone alleging that he had been doing these things. And I think that that is very telling, because Janet Cope spent probably more time with Jimmy Savile than anyone else in his life. And she never detected any sort of improprieties on his part. Now, granted, Jimmy does seem to have deferred to certain women in his white life when it came to his sexual activities, such as his mother, the Duchess. If you'll remember all the way back at the beginning of this series, we talked about how Jimmy stated after buying his mother a flat in Scarborough, he had gone and bought a camper van for himself that he set up on the coast so that he could entertain young women away from his mother's prying eyes. I have a very strong suspicion that if he was doing anything that he believed that Janet Cope would not approve of, he was smart enough and wily enough to do it away from her prying eyes. In this instance, she was mostly based at Stoke Mandeville, where she took care of everything that was the enterprise of Jimmy Savile. I would imagine that he had camper vans in the area, if not on the hospital grounds themselves, where he was able to bring willing participants in his activities away from Janet. We know he did this at Broadmoor Hospital. Even when he had his own set of rooms there, he also had a camper van on the grounds in order to take individuals to. The 90s progressed somewhat lackadaisically for Jimmy. Again, in 94, Jimmel Fix It was finally canceled. He really disappeared from the public eye, except on certain occasions or when he was called upon by the royals or he was involved in some sort of major charity event. In 1999, Louis Theroux began taping a documentary with Savile, and this has become somewhat infamous. It was entitled When Louis Met Jimmy, and it premiered on April 13th, 2000. There are a number of instances in this film that left people talking. The most startling of all was while they were driving, I believe it was in the Irish countryside, Theroux asks Savile about the allegations that he was a pedophile, to which Savile basically stated, and I'm paraphrasing here, how would anyone know if I am or not? I know I'm not. And when asked about the dislike of children that he had claimed so many years beforehand, this is when Jimmy uttered the infamous line, "It throws a lot of salacious tabloid reporters off the trail." Theroux, as well as many others, after Jimmy's death, have taken this to mean Jimmy was admitting on camera in his own way with a wink and a nudge that, yeah, there are rumors about me, and they probably are true. Personally, my takeaway from it was that this was a man who was ancient at this point and really had nothing left to lose by what it was. He said they couldn't take his money from him. They could not take his knighthood away from him or all of the other things that he had done. So he was going to admit to doing some things while not admitting to doing other things. The other things being the allegations that he was a pedophile. I've stated my case on that numerous times. I'm not going to get into it here, but it did get the people of Britain talking, which is exactly what Savile wanted. In fact, during one exchange, which I'm almost certain did not make it into the film, Jimmy told Theroux, "You can make it as negative as you like. See you in court. I'll take a few quid off you, the same as I'll take a few quid off of anybody." This is really the end for Jimmy Savile at this point. He knows that he's only got a number of years left on the planet, and he's willing to do anything that he can to keep both himself and his name in the public conscience. Remember, he's well into his 70s at this point. And if you watch the documentary, beyond a few scenes where it's somewhat disturbing, especially the exchange in the van, Jimmy comes across as a very lonely old man. And I'm not saying that I have any sort of sympathy for him, but it is apparent that despite everything he has in the world, there isn't much left for him, and he really has nobody. He has no real honest-to-God friends. He lives in all these wonderful apartments and houses that he owns, but outside of all the accolades that he's accumulated over the years and some furniture, there really isn't much there. They're sparse in terms of being lived in. When they go to the Scarsborough flat that Jimmy had purchased for the Duchess, he allows Theroux to stay in her room after showing him the Duchess's clothing, which still hung up inside of a standing closet and was encased in plastic because Savile stated he had it dry cleaned once a year. One interesting thing that came out of that segment of the film emerged after the fact when Theroux said that he had a decent sleep, although he got the distinct impression of while he was sleeping that somebody was standing over him in the middle of the night, which is a sensation that others who had stayed with Jimmy claimed to have experienced, almost as though he was standing over their bed while they were sleeping, standing, staring down at them. Which, I'm sure if you were in that position, would be a very disturbing experience, especially on retrospect. Other than this documentary, which again came out in 2000, Jimmy was really absent from public life at this point. He had very few public appearances and paydays. His days were mostly spent at one of his various apartments or homes, one of his camper vans, or at one of the hospitals, which he had made himself a patron saint of. He really was not involved in any sort of public affairs. Another notable moment came in 2007 where Jimmy appeared on the television program Celebrity Big Brother. Because of this appearance on the show, as well as the resulting media coverage, a woman who had experienced abuse at the hands of Jimmy in the 1970s at Duncroft finally got up the nerve to contact police. And this had a snowball effect in that eventually the Surrey police decided to put him down as a person of interest in this particular incident. And this continued to build over the course of a few weeks, with some of the girls being unwilling to cooperate with the investigation, others willing to cooperate with the investigation. However, there was a website known as Friends Reunited, and this is where later, when Savile passed away, that Marion Jones, who was a, I believe he was a producer at the BBC, stumbled across stories concerning Duncroft, because as all of this is going out, these girls begin to talk about what happened to them when they were at the school, and how Seville had taken advantage of them. And again, they're looking back at this with in hindsight, realizing that what he had done is tantamount to abuse. This particular investigation of Jimmy Savile lasted for over 15 months. And that is where we are going to leave our story for this week. It's 2007, 2009, somewhere around there, and Jimmy is really towards the end of his life. He has had open heart surgery to fix clogged arteries. His life has really slowed down. He's nowhere near to being as public as he once was, and girls who had been victims of his attention in years gone by are now starting to reconnect with one another and discuss the things that he had cajoled them to do. Next week is going to be the last in the Jimmy Savile series, where we're going to discuss Jimmy's passing, what happened afterwards, and then I'm going to read some from the various reports that were prepared on him, as well as discuss the fallout for others after Jimmy died. Hope you enjoyed this week's show. The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Until next time, stay morbid.